partners in this room to be a part of the review process for the ordinance. Our perspective has been formed by the on-the-ground observations and more than 20,000 phone calls to our hotline since the last year from people looking for resources in Oregon and reporting possible ICE activity. We've borne witness to the confusion and the lack of clarity due to the actions of agents who dress in plain clothes, wear drive vehicles with no license plates, and of course, cover their faces and do not provide identification. At least 258 detentions have been reported to PERC in Portland proper since July, making this issue an issue that is very much impacting your constituents. PERC's incredible dispatchers have told us how challenging it is to receive phone calls from callers who are unsure which agency they are dealing with. Many hotline calls involve unmarked, suspicious vehicles and people, and this uncertainty results in lost time. They shared that police verifying whether someone is a federal agent may help with imposters, like those who were reportedly interrogating young people on the MAX early last year. And most importantly, it would be helpful to answer the questions of the loved ones left behind. Minutes often mean the difference between transport out of state and access to legal counsel. Having PPB officers able to ascertain with clarity who is involved in a detention or provide documentation of violations would be of great value to the families seeking justice when ICE has broken the law. The reality is that everyday courageous Portlanders are already taking it upon themselves to ask agents who is detaining their neighbors and loved ones here in Portland. Portland police being mandated to do the same and to verify indicia of authority of agents to detain people will help protect your constituents and remind them who the local police are here to protect. I am reminded of a very real moment this would have been appreciated. I happened to be the person accompanying the very next human leaving court and on their way to their vehicle after the first detention in immigration court last June. I will never forget the terror on this woman's face when I met her at the doors of court. "Who was that?" she asked me. "It was ICE, I think," I explained to her. "Well, why are they wearing masks? What happened to the girl in the pink sweater?" Those masked men had walked in, surrounded a woman, and took her out of court, leaving everyone stunned and unsure about what had happened or why, and nobody to ask what authority they had to do so. Like so many others, this woman shared with me that she never thought that something like that would happen in the place that she had fled to. And so I asked this council move to pass this proposal and make it an ordinance, because if agents are bold enough to kidnap people in broad daylight from our communities, they must be held accountable, and law enforcement agents should have the responsibility to document crimes against Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was an excerpt of Tuesday's meeting of the Portland City Council Community and Public Safety Committee. Councilors were hearing an ordinance to ban face coverings and require identification from law enforcement. The ordinance will still have to be heard by the full City Council. You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for being with us.
You are tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Way. Hey, hey, yeah. I get back up when I fall. Good evening. We'd like to welcome you to Trans Positive on KBOO this evening. And we're going to be talking about some political issues and giving some tips from some of our trans elders, including me. And so we usually do our intro and then our pronouns. I just stick with Her Royal Highness, and that covers all bases. And my name is Sheila.
My name is Emma, and I use she and her pronouns.
And my name is Jean, and I use she and her pronouns as well.
Great. So for the show tonight, we're going to be talking about some transgender events in the news. We're going to be covering events that have happened in Kansas, in Florida, West Virginia, and also a ruling regarding transgender inmates in federal prisons. So first, we're going to start with the latest developments in Kansas. Who would like to open that part of the show? Jean, would you be able to talk about the latest that you've heard about Kansas?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Emma. Since I'm the one who first pointed to the evolutions in Kansas several weeks ago, there have been evolutions there. And for those who are not aware, in the state of Kansas, the legislature imposed a pretty broad sweeping anti-trans legislation, which was then vetoed by the governor, but then overridden. The veto was overridden, and so this this law went into effect in Kansas here, I don't know, about a couple of weeks ago, maybe 10 days ago. And one of the elements of this sweeping legislation, Kansas, I think Senate 244, I believe. Yes, Kansas Senate Bill 244, for any of you who want to, not aware, you know, is that it just like automatically cut off the validity of any state issued identification where the holder of that identification had changed any of their information from their birth certificate, their birth at sex at birth, as indicated in any of their state issued identifications, and you know, like driver's licenses and stuff. And it didn't give any kind of, you know, like grace period or anything. It's like you have to go back and get your new driver's license or anything. No, it automatically, like just overnight. So this caused people to be like, I've got a valid driver's license, or was yesterday. Today it's like, not only can I not use my valid driver's license in the state of Kansas, I have to, you know, go get it reissued and everything. And if I'm caught driving, there's like $1,000 fine and plus maybe, you know, time in jail and that kind of stuff. Okay, with that background, as one would expect, as I expected, there were several lawsuits filed almost immediately in the state of Kansas to try to enjoin, to hold in abeyance the implementation of this law. And so, and this is like really rapid, okay? This is rapidly progressing. It didn't take like 3 or 4 days. So, you know, the courts in the state of Kansas said, no, you can't, you cannot, you know, they're not going to enjoin this. They're not going to like hold this in abeyance. So not only did the law pass, it's been appealed into, you know, into the state courts, and the state court system in the state of Kansas has already said, nope, we're enforcing this. And this is the most far-reaching, most outrageous thing that I've ever seen at the state level in terms of the efficacy of it, and you know that you know all identification stuff is like negated almost instantaneously, and it carries the you know, fines, state fines, and even like potential jail time in the state of Kansas if one has you know, either, you know, changed your sex at birth on state issued identifications, or if you are found using sex segregated facilities in any, you know, in any setting. This is absolutely incredible. And so the first level of appeals have already been denied in the state of Kansas. That's the background. And that happened, let's see, I believe it was like last Thursday or something. So there you go. I mean, this is very, very recent.
Wow. Any
comments out there?
Yeah, that's a lot. I mean, yeah. Well, first let me ask Sheila first if Sheila would like to comment.
Well, I think that it helps to put this in the context of some of the wider things that are beyond our community. One of the things that was announced today by the Secretary of War is that he used the terms no quarter. Anybody that opposes us in Iran will be given no quarter. What that means, in everybody remembers this from the Alamo, is that anyone trying to surrender is going to be killed. They will take no prisoners. That's what no quarter means. And if we said, well, he only meant that metaphorically, meaning that we're going to do it in a determined fashion, you don't say that when you're talking in military terms. The word no quarter is absolute mercilessness. In other words, he was saying that our armed services will not abide by international law over the Geneva Conventions. It's a way of saying we don't respect the European community. We don't expect everything that defines what we would call civilized warfare through the years. Now, if that's the way they think on the international arena, is it any surprise that they think of us as less than human and that they intend to give us no quarter, at least in the sense that bathrooms and us are seen as being the place where they've chosen to draw their line in the sand and say, this is so important to us. We view you as such a threat, either to the privacy issues of others or to their sexual security, that we're going to have you go to a restroom that is no longer appropriate for you in terms of the type of dress that you're wearing. And if you're somebody that's been under hormone therapy for a considerable amount of time or have gone through bodily changes, all of that, however embarrassing it might be to now have you go into the assigned at birth bathroom, is irrelevant. And how irrelevant is also the responses of the people that are going to see people coming in that really do look like they don't belong there, but they don't care about that because these people are gender essentialists, and their idea is that we can build a image of what is an appropriate male and female public attire, which is really quite similar to the idea of having to wear a burqa or something like that. But the idea is it's all based on the idea that these things are naturally defined. if they're so natural, then why do we need laws to ensure them? But they're going to the legal route, and the reason that they're going for it is because they want a hidden fist behind this. This is not something that's merely an admonition. They're saying, we'd like you to do this. These are really severe penalties, and they completely ignore the standards of care that apply to people that are transgender, the fact that we have to be diagnosed, the fact that we go through very careful screening before we're admitted to gender change programs. All that is completely irrelevant, because their attitude is, we're going to go along certain parameters of what we think is appropriate in America. And that's happening at the federal level, the state level, the local level, and in ordinary discourse. But the funny thing is that transgender people have made incredible progress for years in the social normativity of language. People are sensitive about pronouns. They are aware of what a dead name means and how offensive that can be. All of those things have been accepted in the constant levels of everyday discourse at the medical level, the legal level, and even at the level of professionalism and even job applications. So to go back to this kind of fairy tale image, to get the genie back in the bottle, is in point of fact not going to work. But what they can do in the meantime is they can terrorize our community, they can make us feel profoundly unwelcome, and they can make it very clear that there are parts of this country that are not safe for us to be in.
Yeah.
Thanks. So Jane, one of the latest things I had heard about the legislation was that it was, there was a request to suspend, to hold this decision while it's under appeal. Do you know if that's still going?
Yes, that's exactly the point that I was making, hon. The court ruled, at least in, you know, already within the state of Kansas, the ACLU and several other folks, you know, appealed this, or not appealed it, but filed for an injunction, okay, a temporary stay in the implementation pending, and they were denied already. I mean, this happened within, I think it was like 3 or 4 days. This was fast tracked in the state of Kansas, mm-hmm. and the Kansas, I believe, Supreme Court in the state of Kansas has already ruled that you know, they will not enjoin this. And then I want to append to a story now, which, you know, this is alleged. The fact that the court has already like denied holding this in abeyance is fact. That's fact. This, what I'm about to say, is what I've heard, what I read, that there is actually a case in the state of Kansas where a trans woman who had changed her name change on her state documents did not extend to a gender marker change. Her gender marker was still that of her sex at birth. Yet she received a notification that her driver's license was invalidated as well, simply because she had gone through the necessary court processes to get a name change. I can't say that that's validated. I don't know that that's true, but I had heard that through another avenue. So here's my point in saying this is not just inflammatory or oh my goodness, you know, the sky is falling. But what this indicates is, if that story is true, that the basis for how the state is identifying folks under this process would indicate that it's not as simple as whether or not they're tracking in their computer databases those of us who may have changed legally our gender markers under the processes at the time. Something as simple as a name change. So, you know, they're utilizing, and here's my point from, you know, way back when I first pointed to the Kansas bills several weeks ago, where I was yelling into the microphone that, you know, this indicates much more than simply a process that's going on in Kansas. This is going on. Kansas is kind of a trial balloon. And this further indicates that what we are seeing is a cross-referencing of multiple governmental databases, which are flagging anything that has gone on in the past, be it legal at the time that you've had a name change or a gender marker change in your documents. There's clearly a move in government that they're cross-referencing these things that which have never been cross-referenced before in a way that says your documentations, all of your stuff is invalid. It's scary because if this is going on in Kansas, it can go on anywhere.
Wow, thank you so much, Gene. That's a great story. There's a couple of other stories I was hoping we could get to tonight. Would it be okay if we moved on?
Oh, mm-hmm. Indeed. Yes, there are plenty of stories.
Okay. By the way, you're listening to Transpositive on KBOO Community Radio. We're at 90.7 FM here in Portland and online at kboo.fm. This is Transpositive. It's a show about transgender issues. And so the next story that we're going to be talking about tonight is the recent ruling in the Fourth Circuit of Appeals, the U.S. Court of Appeals. There was a ruling that's going to affect transgender health care for transgender adults. This week, in a case called Anderson versus Crouch, the decision to be appears at first to be about something relatively narrow, whether a state can refuse to cover gender-affirming surgeries under Medicaid. But as journalists and legal analysts have started digging into the opinion, it's become clear that the implications may be far broader. In particular, the transgender journalist Aaron Reed, who writes the newsletter Aaron in the Morning, argues the legal ruling could open the door to much wider restrictions on transgender healthcare. We're going to be unpacking what the court actually said, what the ruling means, and why many people believe it could shape the next phase of the legal fight over transgender rights regarding healthcare in the United States. The case Anderson versus Crouch involved a challenge to a policy in the state of West Virginia. West Virginia's Medicaid program has long excluded coverage for gender-affirming surgeries. Transgender patients argued that this exclusion violated the Constitution and federal civil rights laws because it discriminated against them based on sex and transgender status. A lower federal court agreed with them and ruled the policy was unconstitutional. But this week, the Fourth Circuit of Appeals reversed the decision. The court ruled that the state of West Virginia is allowed to exclude gender-affirming surgeries from Medicaid coverage. The judge said that states have broad authority to decide what procedures they will and will not fund through Medicaid. In other words, the ruling says that even if a medical treatment exists, and even if doctors recommend it, a state government can still decide not to pay for it through its public insurance program. There's deeper controversies that come to this beyond just Medicaid funding, and those have to do with the reasoning that the court used to justify the decision. In the court's opinion, one of the judges wrote that it is not irrational for the legislature to discourage medical interventions related to gender transition and to encourage people to, quote, appreciate their sex. That phrase, appreciate their sex, has become one of the most widely discussed parts of the ruling. because it suggests something important about how the court views the issues. In many previous civil rights cases, courts have assumed that the government cannot try to change someone's identity as a legitimate policy goal. For example, the court generally rejects laws designed to discourage someone from being gay or discourage someone from belonging to a particular religion. But in this ruling, the court appears to say that a state may legitimately pursue policies intended to discourage gender transition. Again, according to Erin Reed, that reasoning is the most alarming aspect of the decision. In her analysis on Erin in the Morning, she argues that the court is essentially saying that the state has a legitimate interest in steering people away from being transgender. That idea, if adopted more widely by the courts, could fundamentally reshape legal arguments used in cases involving transgender rights. Because if discouraging transition is considered a legitimate government goal, then a wide range of policies could potentially be justified under that reasoning. Another important part of the ruling is how it connects to a recent Supreme Court decision, the U.S. versus Scrimeti. That case involved Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming care for minors. The Supreme Court ruled that states have significant authority to regulate medical treatments involving gender transition for people under 18. What the Fourth Circuit did in Anderson versus Crouch was it took the reasoning from Scrimeti and extended it into a different context. Instead of minors, the case involved adult Medicaid patients. Instead of a direct ban on care, the issue involved insurance coverage. But the court treated the logic essentially the same. The court argued that because there is ongoing political and scientific debate about gender-affirming treatments, state legislators have broad discretion to regulate or restrict them. Critics say that reasoning is deeply problematic. Medical organizations, including the American Medical Association and the American Academy of Pediatricians, have repeatedly stated that gender-affirming care is evidence-based and medically necessary. So what do you think, ladies?
Would you like to hear some thoughts from me on this? The thing that I keep coming back to is this idea that we are entering a period of a complete restructuring of society based upon a kind of an archaic idea that you could get back to a certain image of what meant to be American, and that includes many of the things of the past. That includes our former racism, that involves our sense of ourselves as a people. It involves who is and is not granted full citizenship, including voting rights. It's an overall thing. We are only a part of this. We're not even the most essential part. We're just the most obvious part. The idea is if we can define gender and sexual expression absolutely to the nth degree and then enforce it, not by just social disapprobation, but also by the rule of law and actually putting sanctions on, which eventually could even lead to imprisonment. This is the kind of thing that tells us what's at stake here. And a classic example of that, they asked Donald Trump today about how we will know when we've achieved victory in Iran. And his answer was, I'll feel it in my bones. In other words, his idea is that he, as the executive, can take our country to war and keep us in war until he feels ready to say it's over. Well, that doesn't match our Constitution, does it? But he announces it, and he is not embarrassed to announce it. And the reason he's not embarrassed to announce it is our country is permeated by this idea that we're in sort of an apocalyptic era. They talk about the Constitution all the time, but what they really mean is that we're in a little hiatus period, a little break here, and we're going to forget about the laws for a little while, but they'll all come roaring back once we get society restructured. Their theory is that things have been drifting for a long time under the so-called radical Democrats, and that as a result, they have to do much more radical means to get us back to where they think we should be. And the fact that they're passing laws at all, in some respects, is a remarkable concession on their part, because in point of fact, they are ready to rely upon naked force if need be, completely outside the law. That's the whole purpose of the ICE group, which is basically a Gestapo ravaging our streets. So when we see that and put our own distress against the wider posture of events, we realize that we are the canaries in the coal mine. We're the people that are targeted for something that is so intimate that most people think it's not within the parameters of the law to regulate it at all. It's a matter of social issues, and that and social issues are worked out in everyday discourse between people. In a free republic, that's exactly what we'd expect. You only have to be this hands-on and authoritative when you move into a fascist government. And when you're a fascist government, by definition, you're not American anymore. And that's what the background, basically, for what's going on.
Thanks. Jane, do you have any comments?
Yeah, I would go on to say that, you know, regarding the Fourth Circuit ruling, number one, the Fourth Circuit, is a panel of three judges in the federal government court system. And all three, I believe, in the Fourth Circuit are at least Republican. I believe they're all Trump appointees. Now, you know, when you get to the circuit level of the federal court system, the next step is the Supreme Court. And so, you know, this is kind of on a fast track to a Supreme Court ruling. And that's, I mean, that's as high as you're going to go in the, you know, the court system. So this is scary that it's already at this level. But let me go on to say that in the Scarametti decision that was just referenced here, you know, I don't know what, several months ago, Justice Sotomayor, flagged the problem in her dissent, really, you know, is that, you know, the equality, you know, that is used in the theoretical justification for the Scarametti ruling and goes all the way back. Really, what this is pointing to is this is a devolution to what's the word for the old separate but equal kind of laws that, you know, we dealt with in the 1960s.
The Jim Crow laws.
Jim Crow. Jim Crow. Thank you. Oh, my goodness. Thank goodness somebody at my age forgot it. But okay, so what Sotomayor said in her dissent was drawing a parallel to Loving versus Virginia, which is the landmark case striking down interracial marriage bans way back in the 50s or 60s. And Virginia had argued at that time that its anti-miscegenation law was not racially discriminatory because it banned interracial marriage equally for Black and white citizens alike. The Supreme Court rejected that reasoning in 1967, yet the Fourth Circuit now embraces its mirror image, a ban that targets a medical need unique to transgender people. And they say it is not discriminatory because it technically applies to everyone. It is the equivalent of taxing yarmulkes and claiming the tax is not anti-Semitic because anyone, Jewish or not, who wears the yarmulke must pay. It's like, we're not being discriminatory against trans people because we're banning, you know, these things for everyone. And so this is literally a step back in legal logic in this country of coming on 60 years, 55 years at least, 60 years. This goes back to 1967. So I wanted to point that out as well.
Thank you, Jean. If it's all right, I'd like to move on. We still have two more stories to get to. You want to talk
Indeed.
About Florida?
Thank
Florida
you.
And also about federal prisoners. So Jean, do you want to talk about Florida?
Oh, well, very simply, the state of Florida, the legislature in the state of Florida has passed a legislation, which we're going to assume, you know, the governor, DeSantis is going to, you know, sign into law, that says in summary that, the governor has the authority under the Florida Constitution to suspend any lower level state or local official from their position. Okay, so, you know, whether they were elected or not in your city, county, whatever, or not. The governor has the authority to, like, boot them out of their position without appeal to anything other than the Florida State Senate, which, by the way, has a super majority proof majority. So you can appeal to the state Senate, but good luck, you know, because, you know, they're all on Governor DeSantis's side. But so the governor has the authority. If any lower level official elected or appointed in the state of Florida is found to have supported or facilitated DEI, okay, you know, diversity, you know, and inclusionary policies or activities in their jurisdiction, anything that supports anything that is DEI related, which clearly and it very specifically extends to LGBTIQ supportive, you know, anything allowing. For instance, theoretically, you know, the display of pride flags in their jurisdiction, the governor has the authority to absolutely kick that person out of their position with appeal only to the state Senate, which is going to validate whatever the governor does. And that is, oh my goodness, that's just within the last week. That's within the last several days, this thing is in Florida.
Oh, that's just crazy. Yeah, so Shayla, do you want to comment on that first?
Well, once again, we see the intrusion and the intrusiveness of these types of things. And whenever it deals with imprisonment, I was talking to Gene earlier about this, and we were discussing and I the issue of punitiveness in our culture. And if we really think about the American prison industrial complex, which is what it is, it's there to terrorize people that are not in prison. It's there to say, you could be here too. And it's this black hole into which people disappear. And how often do you hear of people that are touring prisons to make sure that they're up to snuff? I mean, we always hear about things like Rikers Island in New York, and we hear about other famous prisons. In fact, a little while ago, Donald Trump was, before he decided to say we should annex Greenland, he was saying we should grab Alcatraz back because it's kind of a historical monument. It's kind of a cool place. It's kind of a thing that's kind of part of our history, but not as something to be regretted, but as sort of a kind of a, you know, let's bring Auschwitz back again. You know, it in other words, it's instead of representing something that just was a prison, it represented a state of mind. It was the idea that we can keep you afraid. And if you look at the basis of inequities in society, what do you think gets people to work for under wages, watch themselves falling behind more and more economically all the time? What gets them to go to work? Why don't we have a French Revolution with pitchforks and everything? And why don't we do that? And the answer is because there's an underlying sense of terror that you really feel when you're in a ghetto community or you're in an area where people accept violence as being part of their daily life. Well, this is what we experience. We as transgender people they've done studies of what our net earnings are, and especially amongst young, that in many cases they get driven into sex work because if they are clearly manifesting a contrary gender and there's no place for them to go to the bathroom, if there's a fear that they're going to lose customers because they've hired a transgender employee, for whatever reason, we are automatically in the lowest levels of things. And when we are treated like that all the time, what keeps us there is fear. And prison is only an example of that. So we use prisons as places to be unpleasant on purpose. We deliberately dehumanize people. We take away their identity. We take away their clothing. We take away, if it's a woman's prison, oftentimes, even in a recent, I had a friend that was in jail recently, said, there's no mirror. There's kind of a plate of some sort of a reflective substance, but you don't get a clear image of yourself. Well, it's very hard to maintain a sense of yourself, particularly as a woman, if you're denied makeup and things that you're used to looking and seeing your face looking back at you each day, especially if you're transgender. So these are just all examples of how we do social engineering by having the threat of violence, even when it's not directly expressed.
Well, that's great. I mean, so Sheila just time traveled from the future and commented on our prison story before we got to it, which is great. But we're still talking about Florida. So if it's okay, I'd like to comment on Jean's.
Please go ahead, hon.
Yeah, thanks so much. And then we'll go to our last story will be the federal prison story. So, you know, this DEI thing, it's kind of crazy. I mean, that Ron DeSantis thinks that he has these kinds of powers. You know, first of all, this is going to give local government, this is going to give the DeSantis administration the same excuses that it's given, like the people in the federal government. I mean, to like with Trump and with Hegseth and with other secretaries, where they can fire people who are running offices because they say they're DEI hires, even if they were just hired because they did a good job. I mean, that's how Pete Hegseth and Donald Trump were busy getting rid of women leaders and people of color leaders in the military at the highest levels. And they were saying that they were DEI hires, which is just, so this is going to reinforce white supremacy, and it's going to have a really negative effect on, and for transgender people, it's, I mean, almost anybody who applies for a job in Florida with a, you know, any kind of a federal, with any kind of a state or city agency may not be hired simply because they're transgender. Because, I mean, if they're hired, it may look to the governor and to lawmakers as if they're doing DEI when they hire somebody who's transgender simply because of the fact that they're transgender. So
if I may, Emma, I need to interject.
Please.
The Florida bill, which is in law, which is Senate Bill 1134, is sweeping. It's not simply, you know, hires. It's not people hired into staff positions. This allows the governor to absolutely negate elected officials. Any elected official that is yes.
See, I was looking at this and I was trying to understand. I did while you were talking about it, I did a little bit of research on it. I was trying to understand because that's what I thought you were saying at first when you started the story, and I thought
that is what
I was thinking, you can't do that because, you know, that's, I mean, you can't remove elected officials who've been elected by their constituency just because you're the governor, because that's violating fundamental constitutional rights of due process and representation.
You would think, wouldn't you?
Yeah. So, yeah, that's...
Can I just something here on this?
Please.
One of the things that we've seen this in even the most repressive states, oftentimes major cities go the exact opposite from the what we call the rural districts. Now, I don't know why that's so. You would think that rural districts where people need to rely on each other to survive would be more inclined to be wanting diversity, wanting inclusion. They'd want these things, but in point of fact, it doesn't go that way. The cities tend to be liberal, particularly if they're college towns, because they get students from all over the country in the different schools. And what happens is that this is an effort to say we're going to have just one standard, and we don't want individual communities saying we're going to pass non-discrimination laws towards transgender people or recognize our existence. So this is an effort to say we want just the opposite. We do not want diversity. We want to have a monochromatic society where everybody looks and acts the same. We don't want inclusion. We want exclusion. We want to have certain groups of people that are held to not have the rights of ordinary citizens. So we go diversity, inclusiveness, and equity. Well, what's the opposite of equity? Equity means non-equity. In other words, unfairness. So even the use of our language indicates that to go against these things or to be against woke culture, the opposite is to be asleep, unaware, ignorant, out of touch. But they never put it that way. They always presume that anything progressive is evil. Anything that's regressive is good. Even our language shows that they are making the wrong directional choices here. But that doesn't matter, because when you're trying to control other people and keep people in fear, that's the kind of tactics that you use. And we're seeing that every day as applied to ourselves as trans people.
Well, we've got about 10 minutes left, so if it's okay, ladies, I'd like to move on to the very last story.
Oh, yeah, let's get to that. I was looking at the clock, too, Ella.
Thanks. So the very last story we have tonight on TransPositive, reports have emerged that new policies within the Federal Bureau of Prisons may lead to transgender inmates being taken off of hormone therapy. Advocates have described this as forced medical detransition. Under the reported policy changes, prisons may stop providing gender-affirming surgeries, restrict access to hormone therapy, remove gender-affirming items such as binders, wigs, or makeup, and replace hormone treatment with psychotherapy or psychiatric medications. For incarcerated transgender people who have been receiving hormones for years, being forced to stop treatment can have serious medical consequences. Doctors warn that abruptly ending hormone therapy can cause severe depression, anxiety, and physical health risks. In her coverage of the story, Erin Reed argues that these policies represent more than just a change in prison medical care. Erin Reed suggests they are part of a broader federal shift in policy toward transgender people. Historically, prisons have often been used as testing grounds for controversial policies. People in prison have few legal protections. Courts often give prison administrators wide discretion, and policy policies implemented there sometimes appear later in other contexts. So part of what's going on with this story is that there's about 2,200 federal inmates in the United States who are transgender. And I don't know if I quite said it clearly when I was reading my prepared script, but what I was trying to say is that this could force people to go through, I think it's called deconversion therapy, or no, conversion therapy, that's what it is. Conversion therapy. And in prison, I mean, this is actually not only are women who go into the federal prison system being forced to, I mean, they're already in a men's prison. This is mostly about transgender women. I mean, it's also about transgender men, but it's, you know, almost everything they do here is focused on transgender women. And what they're trying to do is, I mean, they're taking away their hormones, they're taking away their clothes, they're taking away their makeup, they're denying them access to any kind of surgeries, they're making them wear men's clothes. And on top of all of that, they're also trying to do, they're trying to brainwash them by making them go through conversion therapy, which is, you know, whenever I hear about this conversion therapy, I remember that. Do you remember that movie from like 2000 with, do you remember that movie from 2000 about this? It was with RuPaul. It was so funny. It was with RuPaul, and it was about this girl who gets sent to this like conversion therapy group home for like, it's like conversion therapy summer camp, and everybody in the group in the summer camp is basically they're all queer, but their parents have sent them to conversion therapy summer camp so that they won't be queer, and RuPaul plays a camp counselor. Who's like trying to, you know, teach them all how to be straight, but RuPaul just can't teach them how to be straight. And in the end, they like, some of them run away. The movie was so funny. I think it was called But I'm a Cheerleader. And it was so funny. It was, I just recommend going to watch this movie. It's on Netflix, and it's like, it's the best movie for understanding this issue about trying to force queer people and, you know, trans people and gay people into conversion therapy. It's ridiculous. And to think that our prisons are going to be used as a place where this horrendous practice is forced upon people who are incarcerated, in addition to taking away everything that gives them dignity as a human being, is just unforgivable.
Unforgivable, but it's very enforceable, and that's the point. And that's, you know, number one, even I hate to invoke, you know, my superiority in terms of age, Emma, but, you know, conversion therapy is not, you know, while it may have been, you know, shortly after, you know, the year 2000, a subject, you know, suitable for a comedic movie, it's not comedic, nor was it ever comedic. And it's, you know, and yes, you're exactly right. You know, and the whole devolution of, you know, the point of this Fourth Circuit ruling is it's taking us back to an era where it took a lot of years and a lot of suffering and a lot of effort to get, you know, the courts to recognize that preventing or trans-related health care, gender-affirming health care for incarcerated folks was constituted cruel and unusual punishment. Okay? That was the logic back then. And it's still the logic now. And And so what this constitutes is this is the beginning of a reversal in legal logic. That whole concept that, you know, it doesn't matter how far you are in your transition or whatever. And what began this incremental attack on the concept in the first place was that we were successful as a community in saying, you know, incarcerated folks should not be excluded from receiving health care that is deemed medically necessary, you know, while they're incarcerated. So it's, you know, it's, I mean, that's, it's that simple. And now what we're hearing with this Fourth Circuit is the beginnings of a ruling that will, and again, rapidly, this is rapidly going to progress to the United States Supreme Court, which will then set a national level precedent. With this concept, it's like, no, we don't really consider trans healthcare to be, you know, medically necessary or the exclusion thereof to be cruel and unusual. That's what this is all about. That's the key to this. You can't look at the Fourth Circuit's ruling right now and say, oh, this is like definitive. No, this is just getting plugged into the rapid, what's becoming more incredibly rapid evolution and escalation to Supreme Court level rulings, which then set, it's like, this is the law of the land, you know, presidential law. Okay. So this is that, you know, this is like, we're ringing serious, you know, chimes and alarms here.
Well, ladies, we have 3 minutes left for the show. So I think it's probably about time to wrap up. Let's give Sheila the last word, and then we'll all just say goodnight.
One of the things that we're noticing is the underlying hysteria and urgency of all of these anti-trans narratives and all of the other things, whether they're talking about defending America against the decline of Western civilization, whether they're talking about setting up a new colonial empire where we get to absorb other countries and then pump their oil and then grab a chunk of it for ourselves or our companies, whether we're talking about the superiority of the United States currency over other currencies. All of these things have an apocalyptic quality that now is the moment of truth. And that's why they have drawn, as I say, their line in the sand, and they're saying, you're either with us or you're against us. You're either American or you're a criminal. You're either gay or you're straight. Everything is designed to make this the final confrontation of every evil that they can put their finger on. And if it takes people out, if it means bombing little girls in schools in Iran and then denying it, they're willing to do it because their idea is that the more brutal they are, the more effective they will become. And that's something that we as a community, remembering our ghetto consciousness, remembering what we had to do to survive in past times, such as the AIDS epidemic and how we stood together, that's what's going to get us through this. And there's going to be more friends than we can count, because if they come for us, they're coming for a lot of other people too. And they're betraying how nasty they are by the means that they're employing.
Well, Jean, Sheila, it's been really great conversation tonight on Transpositive. Thanks so much for joining us here. And we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Emma. And all I can say is, I don't know, you guys out there, keep your eye on the prize. You know, just hold on, hold on.
transgender people don't live here.
I've never met anyone who's transgender.
I swear I don't know someone who's transgender.
Transgender and non-binary people like me hear this all the time.
But according to the HRC Foundation, there are more than 2 million transgender people in the United States.
We live in every community across this country.
You might be surprised to hear that there are more transgender and non-binary people in the United States than there are
Starbucks,
McDonald's, and Walmart locations combined.
In fact, if you put us all together,
there'd be more non-binary and transgender folks than the populations of DC,
or Nebraska,
or Maine,
or Idaho,
or West Virginia.
As a matter of fact, 15 states have a lower population than the amount of trans folks in the US.
So here are a few things to keep in mind.
You don't always know when a person is trans.
But we're your neighbors,
your coworkers,
your students,
your customers,
and even your friends and family.
We exist in every culture, todas las culturas, throughout human history.
And while we're more visible than ever before,
sometimes you just don't see us.
So when you hear about politicians pushing forward discriminatory bills,
know this, these bills address problems that aren't even real. Problems.